Is the BBC World Service, the world's radio station.
Welcome to Radio Chatskill. I'm Patricia Rubio, filling in for Tim Bruno. On today's show, we'll speak to Andy Yates, president of the National MS Societies, about MS Education and Awareness Month. And live in our studio, Dr. Neil Hitch from the Museum at Bethel Woods, talking about the Woodstock Oral History Initiative. And then also live in our studio, the one and only Noah Colina will be talking about his upcoming workshop, Why We Photograph. And then we'll be speaking to Kate Sharon Mitchell about spinning women's history. This is all happening today on Radio Chatskill. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. A federal judge in Florida is scheduled to hear arguments at this hour on whether to dismiss the case against former President Donald Trump involving his handling of classified documents after he left the White House. NPR's Giles Snyder has more.
Donald Trump's lawyers are seeking to have the documents case dismissed by a federal judge he appointed, Judge Eileen Cannon. Cannon will consider two motions to dismiss Special Counsel Jack Smith's case. Trump's lawyers argue he was entitled to retain the documents as a former president, and that Smith's use of the Espionage Act is unconstitutionally vague. Prosecutors say Trump's claims show that he believes he is above the law.
NPR's Giles Snyder. The SpaceX Starship blasted off from the company's launch site near Brownsville, Texas this morning. It's a futuristic craft designed to carry someday to carry astronauts to the moon and beyond. This is the third test flight for the uncrewed Starship. The previous flights last year ended with explosions. The Israeli military says it's planning to move some of the Palestinians now sheltering in the town of Rafah to what it called humanitarian islands. More than a million people are in the border town, which is currently the main entry point for most of the humanitarian aid entering Gaza. NPR's Dee Paravez has more.
The Israeli military announced it plans to move people from Rafah in southern Gaza to central Gaza in advance of a ground invasion. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Hamas battalions are still operating in Rafah. The sheer number of people now sheltering there, including some 600,000 children, according to UNICEF, has triggered concerns for the U.S. as well as humanitarian groups who say that an invasion of Rafah would be catastrophic. Many Palestinians have moved to Rafah from elsewhere in Gaza at Israel's urging. Dee Paravez, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Stocks opened higher this morning as the Commerce Department reported a smaller-than-expected jump in retail sales last month. They're falling now. NPR's Scott Horsley has more.
Retail sales rose 0.6% last month, a modest rebound after January's post-holiday slump. Spending at gas stations rose 0.9%, which was not enough to keep pace with the jump in gasoline prices. People also spent more at restaurants, car dealers, and home and garden stores in February, while spending at grocery stores and online retailers was slightly lower. Stock in U.S. Steel opened down after news that President Biden formally opposes the $1.4 billion sale of the company to Japanese steelmaker Nippon Steel. U.S. Steel is headquartered in the political swing state of Pennsylvania. And new claims for unemployment benefits showed little change last week. 209,000 people applied for jobless aid. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks are now moving lower. The Dow is down 152 points. The S&P is down 21. This is NPR News. A high court in Japan said today the country's ban on same-sex marriage is Opinion polls show such unions are supported by the Japanese public, but opposed by the government. The court doesn't have the power to overturn the current law. A new study published in the New England Journal of Medicine finds colorectal cancer can be detected with a new type of blood test. NPR's Allison Arbery reports.
The study finds the blood-based screening test detects 83% of people with colorectal cancer. The test, developed by Guardant Health, can be done from a simple blood draw and detects cancer by analyzing alterations in fragments of DNA. Dr. Barbara Jung, president of the American Gastroenterological Association, says if approved, the test could help improve early detection.
I do think having something where you can just do a blood draw versus undergoing an invasive test will reach more people.
Though people with a positive test will still require a colonoscopy. At a time when colorectal cancer is on the rise, many adults have not been screened for the disease, despite recommendations that regular screenings should begin at age 45. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Happy Pi Day for those who celebrate, typically rocket scientists and math enthusiasts. It's March 14th. 314 correlates to the first three digits of the infinite number pi, the mathematical constant that expresses the ratio of a circle's circumference to its diameter. Pi Day is often celebrated with a slice of pie or just a slice. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm your host, Patricio Robayo. This week has been designated as MS Awareness Week, and March is National MS Education Awareness Month. Nationally and globally, there is a growing awareness about multiple sclerosis, people living with the disease, and the MS movement. The National MS Society amplifies the stories of the people living with MS to raise awareness every day and during MS Awareness Week. Joining us this morning is Andy Yates, president of the National MS Society's Upstate New York chapter. Good morning, Andy.
Hey, Patricio. Thanks for having me.
No, thank you so much for being here. So let's remind folks exactly what is MS and what are the types of MS?
Great question. So MS is basically the deterioration of the myelin sheath that's affecting your central nervous system. So think your brain, your spinal cord, optic nerve. And so basically when this myelin sheath is deteriorated, the signals that are moving around your body that affect so many different things aren't communicating correctly. I've heard it said that, you know, it's like if your phone or your computer charger, you know, that kind of covering, the white or black covering of those wires, if those get damaged, you know, it's not charging correctly and you're not getting the right signal. So that's basically what's happening. And, you know, and it can affect, you know, so many different things. It can cause numbness. It can cause blindness, mobility issues, which is probably what people think about most. It can affect your concentration. It can affect, you can have bladder issues. So many different things. And that's what makes this disease so difficult is that it's, you know, often difficult to diagnose because it presents in so many different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just reading an article about Christina Applegate, the actress, and she said that, you know, she felt like she may have had her disease much earlier on, that she had symptoms that she ignored. Can you go over that if what are some of the symptoms of MS and maybe early stages of MS?
Right. That's a great question. And that does come up quite a bit. I meet folks that they often tell me in hindsight, I was suffering with this, you know, much longer than I realized before I, you know, took the initiative to talk to my doctor. In about 25% of folks, it manifests the first time in vision issues. So you got some blurriness in your vision, for instance. And for 25% of folks, that's what kind of clues them in that, hey, something's wrong. Maybe I should check it out. And what makes this question so important and why MS Awareness Month and MS Awareness Week is so significant is to get the word out about this, is that we've got so much new evidence that if a person can get diagnosed early, they can get on the right disease-modifying therapy early, as soon as possible, to work with their neurologist to find what works for them. The good news is there's about 25 disease-modifying therapies these days. Not too many years ago, there weren't any disease-modifying therapies. Now there's 25. And so if you can get on the right one, the new research is saying that it really is beneficial to the course of your disease progression. You know, the types of MS that you hear most often talked about are relapsing and remitting MS and progressive MS. With progressive, you know, it's like what it sounds like. It's, you know, it's getting worse over time. But most folks have relapsing and remitting, and that means that you're kind of having attacks periodically. But if you can get on the right disease-modifying therapy, those attacks, the time in between the attacks become longer and longer. I meet folks that they're on a drug that works for them, and they might go years without a relapse. And so I would just encourage folks, if you're thinking that, you know, something might be going on, something's not feeling quite right, you know, go to the MS Society's website, nationalmssociety.org, read up about it, you know, do your research, then talk to your doctor and try to figure it out as soon as possible so you can get on the right medicine for you.
So who exactly gets MS? Is it hereditary? Is it something, you know, the genes? Is it something that happens to you, like brain trauma or anything like that? Who actually gets MS?
Good question. It's the numbers work out. It's 75% women, 25% men. There is some evidence that even though it's 25% men, men actually have a more difficult disease progression, a faster disease progression. So, you know, so the 75-25 split. And what we found is that it can affect all ethnicities. There's no kind of one group of people that are more likely to get it. I think in the old days, people used to think this was a white woman's disease. And, you know, all the new evidence, you know, doesn't support that this can affect anybody. It does seem like there might be an aspect of a genetic component. But honestly, we don't know, you know, we don't know the precise cause. And that's why we continue to invest, you know, so much into research. You know, I'm really proud to say that since its founding in 1946 here in New York State, the MS Society has invested $1.2 billion in research. Wow. So of those 25 disease-modifying therapies that I mentioned, the MS Society was integral in the development of, you know, all of those. You know, we helped pave the way for all of them. So we're really proud of that.
So you mentioned about some treatment options early on. Can you talk more about that? Exactly what are the treatment options if a person does get diagnosed with MS?
Yep, that's another one of the success stories, is that there are several different types of treatments. There are injections, there are infusions, there are oral medications. We're hearing more about stem cell transplants. And so there's several different options moving forward, but, you know, you've got to work with your neurologist and find the treatment that works best for you.
Absolutely. So, and of course, you know, if someone gets diagnosed, you want to be hopeful and you want to say, hey, that there is a cure down the line. So we can tell us about the latest in the search for a cure for MS.
Yep. I think that's one of the exciting things is that, you know, we're working with neurologists and researchers, you know, all over the country and all over the world. The National MS Society here in the U.S. is the largest MS organization in the entire world. And we're actually coordinating with MS researchers, scientists, doctors globally to figure out, you know, what's the research and what are the treatments that are most promising, and to help call attention to that research and, you know, provide funding for the most promising research, no matter where it's happening. If the research is happening here, if it's happening, you know, somewhere in Europe, you know, whatever is the most promising to find a cure, you know, that's what we're leaning into. And so, you know, everybody that I talk to is really optimistic that we are going to find a cure, and we're approaching it in so many different, you know, so many different directions. There's not, you know, one thing that's going to be, you know, kind of this magic, you know, magic pill. It's going to be, you know, in different people, the cure is going to look different. And so we've got to find those opportunities and fund those opportunities you know, bring those, you know, to be available for everybody.
Absolutely. This is, it sounds like it's become a global effort to find a cure.
Yep, absolutely.
So where can folks get more information about MS? You mentioned a website before. If you want to mention it again or...
Yep. So it's... Yeah, let me mention a couple things. It's nationalmssociety.org. And this is the largest repository of information about MS, you know, anywhere in the world. So this is really your one-stop shop to learn about MS. But I also want to highlight a program that we're really proud of called the MS Navigator Program. And what's great about this is that it's a team of trained MS specialists that are actually by their phone. You can actually call these folks one-on-one, you know, talk to a real person, you know, talk about your very specific situation. You know, maybe you're experiencing some of these symptoms and, you know, you're interested in maybe finding the right doctor in your area. You know, maybe you've already been diagnosed and you're thinking about, you know, it might be time that I need to disclose this diagnosis to my employer. You know, that's a scary situation. So you might want to call an MS Navigator to get some advice about that. You know, maybe you've got some mobility issues and you might need some home modifications. You know, you might want to, you know, talk to an MS Navigator about getting advice about, you know, how to, you know, get funding for that. And so there's so many different things that MS Navigators can help with. And so, you know, I'd love to give the phone number. You can access it on the website, but sure. Anybody can call if you're interested in any of this information, 1-800-344-4867. 1-800-344-4867. And something we're really proud of with MS Navigators is that it doesn't matter if you live in the Catskills, you live in Manhattan, you live in Juneau, Alaska, you can call this exact phone number and talk to a real person about your specific issues related to MS and, you know, to get you, you know, on the right track to, you know, live your best life.
Absolutely. We were talking to Andy Yates, president of the National MS Society's Upstate New York chapter, about National MS Month, and this week has been designated MS Awareness Week. Andy, thank you so much for talking to us and really bringing light to this disease that's really now been, I don't know any person now in my life personally that has not been affected by MS in some capacity. So thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Thank you, Patricio.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. We'll be right back. We talk to Neil Hitch about the museum at the Museum of Bethel Woods Oral History Initiative.
Not looking good.
This is Thane Peterson, host of Living Jazz. Saturday at noon, I bring you 2 hours of the very best of the current jazz scene, along with a little bit of classic jazz thrown into the mix. It's wonderful music that will warm your heart and soothe your soul. Join me for Living Jazz, noon to 2 Saturday, only on Radio Catskill.
This year, St. Patrick's Day falls on a Sunday. I'm Graham Rice, and next time I bring you a special double-length edition of the Wagon Load of Monkeys, Wagon Load Plus, you might say. 2 hours of Irish music to celebrate St. Patrick's Day. Join me, please, on Sunday afternoon at 3.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, we meet Toñita, the owner of the last Puerto Rican social club in Brooklyn, and learn about how she's fighting erasure with free food, free dance, and building solidarity with her community.
It's a place where we're allowed to come together, we're allowed to gather, we're allowed to be.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. Throughout 2004, curators from the museum at the Bethel Woods are traveling the country and across New York State to capture unique Woodstock stories, with an overall goal of collecting 4,500 stories from people who attended the festival. That is only 1% of those who found their way to Yasker's Farm. Yet this archive will be the most significant collective memory of Woodstock music and art fair. Joining us now live in the studio is Dr. Neil Hitch, Senior Coordinator, Curator, at the Museum of Bethel Woods. Good morning. Welcome to the studio.
Hey, thanks very much.
So you just came back from Boston, where you were capturing the Woodstock stories. I saw on your Instagram that on your first day there, you interviewed 27 people.
Yeah, that was a lot. So we were 5 days in Boston. Typically, we do 8 people in a day. We have a pretty efficient system that we've developed over the last 3 years. We were overwhelmed with the response from Boston. Just unbelievable. I can't believe so many Bostonians came up here to the Catskills to attend Woodstock. But it was great. We did 92 people. We interviewed 92 people over the last 5 days. Our last interview was yesterday at 5 o'clock. So
wow.
This was just right there.
Now, why is this project so important to the memory and the history of Woodstock?
Well, the average age of the person who attended Woodstock's probably around 18, 19, 20 years old, and they are only getting older. And so, one of the things that I say, there were people in their 50s and their 40s there, but they're no longer here to interview.
Right.
So we really are getting down to where we would like to interview as many people as we can. We, in 2020, coming out of COVID, we started getting a lot of contacts from people that wanted to talk about their experience, wanted to sign up on our alumni registry. And we started doing Zoom interviews with people. What we found is that people had a lot of time they were home and they were thinking about life and legacy and started thinking about, memories. And so we started this oral history initiative, putting staff capacity for 5 years toward collecting as many stories as we can. We were very lucky to have received an IMLS grant last year. We went to the West Coast. We did a lot on the West Coast. This year, with an award from the National Endowment for the Humanities, we'll be up and down the East Coast, specifically and especially in New York State, and collect as many New York stories as possible.
Right. I remember when the 50th anniversary of Woodstock came around and Bethel Woods Center of the Arts had that museum. I know you weren't the curator at the time, but I remember they had one part of it, the exhibit, was just stories of folks, video stories. And that was that's one of the best parts of it, because we see all the stuff, the hoopla, the posters, it's all great. But it was just personal stories that I really enjoyed of how they got there or where they came and the memories they had, and just really made the event real for me.
Yes, that in the We Are Golden exhibit was, a partnership with Rochester Institute of Technology. That was some amazing stories. One of the things, people have given stories, they've done interviews here on the radio. They did newspaper articles, interviews with newspaper people at the 20th and at the 25th and at the 40th and at the 50th. There's a difference in what we are doing today. So we are doing what we call long form oral histories, which will really look at somebody's experience over this 3-day festival that was at a period that's often transforming for them as they're moving from college into adulthood or high school into college. And we track what that relationship is or what the meaning is over the course of a life. And today you can look back on that Woodstock experience with this filter of your life, right? At how that really you've seen that play out. And when I say that, for a lot of people, what they saw at Woodstock was, half a million people coming together, but really who had this plan for peace and music, and they experienced this 3 days of peace and music. And what they saw was something that has reflected a hope that peace is possible, that sharing and caring and, being kind of living together as people as possible. And so often you see that in carried out through what they did for a living or maybe through other experience they've had, how they've raised their children. So it's kind of an amazing thing to see. But we're also collecting these with the aspect of preservation. We're not doing a documentary. We're not doing an exhibit. What we're doing is we're building a collection of oral histories that will exist for future historians to look at.
Absolutely, yeah. Awesome point there that, it's not doing for the exhibit now, what's happening now, but just for future generations going down the line to see what actually happened here in Sullivan County. Of some of the stories that you've collected so far, have any of them surprised you?
It's not that they've surprised us. Every story is unique. We have this tagline we say, which is Woodstock's not one story. It's 450,000 stories. And every time, like, I will tell you, every time I sit and I speak with someone, they will say something that you've never heard before. It's a part of a puzzle. Everyone has kind of a similar story because they all saw the same bands. They all were at the same place. But everyone has such a unique, both a perspective, but also a unique experience. One of the things, so I heard this story over the weekend. Somebody was saying that we know there's this site called the Information Booth, and it's where people went up to try and find people they had lost or find a ride somewhere. We have bunches and bunches of pictures of it. It's like a little kiosk that was built, and people sat in it and gave you information. Giant sign that says information. But a young lady, she was a young lady at the time of the interview, or at the time of Woodstock. Well, I'll call her a young lady.
Right.
This young lady went up to the she had lost her sister. So her and her sister had come. They were walking down 17B. They got separated, and she came into the festival. And one of her she said this is the greatest 3 days of her life. She's never experienced anything so amazing. Stood right in front of the stage, would go to the information booth and give them a note saying, you know, I'm looking for my sister. She says there's a guy in the information booth with a microphone, and he would like say, I'm, you know, looking for so-and-so's sister. If you're in the area, please come to the information booth. And that would happen over the course of the time. Never heard that story before. You hear people on, you know, the announcements on stage looking for people. We very well aware of that. You'd pass a note up to the chipmunk on stage, and you know, he would say, you know, if you are wheat germ, please come to, you know, to the looking for your medicine or something. But this is the first time we've ever heard this story, and it's important. Because about 2 years ago, this picture came up of the information booth, and we're kind of looking at it. The museum has these two speakers on top of it. No one had really ever seen it before or kind of understood. And we are like, what are the speakers? Why are there speakers on this thing? That seems like a tiny, insignificant thing.
Yeah.
But at the historic site, what we're trying to do is kind of document all of these small things we call the lost histories and kind of put these things together as the research questions about how, one is how people found each other, how people interacted with the site, how, you know, you can, how you find your sister, right? In a sea of 500,000 people. And then we putting together like what we call the behind the scene tour, where we put people on a golf cart and we take you and show you where these places happen.
Right.
So if you were there at the festival and you had lost your sister and you had this memory of all these places you walked to try and find her, you could come do a tour where we would take you out to those spaces and say, this is where the information booth was. This is, you would have walked to here. You would have walked to there to your camp. So those things, what we've been doing is trying to increase what I call place-based interpretation, which is increasing engagement with the historic site. Site became listed on the National Register of Historic Places in 2017. You know, since then, we've really been trying to get more people out into the site and see things that you weren't able to see before.
Right. Yeah. It almost seemed like that weekend, it seemed like a mini city cropped up out of nowhere, and they sort of self-managed each other. And in a way that's like, and it's interesting that you are exploring that. Like, how did that happen? How did the information booth happen? How did all this little logistics happen? And how did the stage get built? I remember in 50th anniversary, they talked about the plywood and how they searching for the plywood, missing plywood from the stage, and how that had a life afterwards. All those little stories really makes the festival what it is.
Yeah, over the 3 days, August 14th to 17th, 18th, if you include Monday, it becomes the third largest city in the state of New York.
Wow.
And then you think about what it would take to manage a city. Like, all of those things have to happen, right? Whether it's plumbing, whether it's food, whether it's medical. And I mean, the stories are none of it was happened efficiently, right? Like, there weren't enough bathrooms. There wasn't enough food. There's probably way too much mud. At the same time, there was a plan for peace, and that was planned. It was, you know, written up. There were documents they had, and that worked. So even the overwhelming number of people, and this is clear, this is what is clearly coming out of the oral histories. Even with the overwhelming amount of people, the lack of facilities, the horrible weather that the plan for peace worked. And people had this experience for 3 days where they just remember everyone being sharing and caring for one another and sitting through, you know, in the mud in a disaster area and leaving with the idea that, you know, peace is a plan. Like, that can happen.
Yeah, definitely. You're off to the Flower Power Cruise starting on March 19th to 28th. When you get back to begin the New York phase, where will you be in New York and how can folks get involved?
So we will be in the city. We'll be in New York April 2nd and 3rd. We will be in several places in the upcoming probably next 3 months. Many of those are not quite planned yet. We will be in Cooperstown. We'll be in probably in Syracuse, probably somewhere else upstate. The way to get in touch with us through the website, BethelWoodsCenter.org. Very specifically, you can contact the Oral History Program through oralhistory@BethelWoodsCenter.org. We are scheduling people, so you have to get in touch with the curator there through oralhistory@BethelWoodsCenter.org, and we will schedule you in a place. There's an online on the website. There's an online, you know, you can click some boxes and say, I'm interested in being in San Diego. I'm interested in being in New York City. I'm interested in being Cooperstown. So that all is pretty efficient. We're connecting with people. We're connecting with about 20 people a day. So it's really been amazing.
We were talking to Dr. Neil Hitch, curator for the museum at Bethel Woods, talking about the Woodstock Oral History Initiative that they're doing. This is a really great capturing of, he said, history, not only of the festival, really Sullivan County history and American history. This really sort of changed a generation. So, Dr. Hitch, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Thank you very much.
We'll be right back. I'm talking to Noah Kalina about his upcoming workshop. This is Radio Catskill.
My name is Mark, and I want to tell you about my show. It's called Ambient Barn, and it's a curated deep dive into the expansive world of electronic music. Each week, we'll showcase a particular genre or theme. Everything from the early pioneers to the latest underground artists, trends, and microgenres. So plug in with me Sunday night at 11 p.m. Because the coolest stuff always happens late at night. Tune in Sunday night at 11 p.m. only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
On Catskill Character this week, my guest is author Dawn McIntyre. We're going to talk about Dawn, her writing techniques, and how she got from Passaic, New Jersey to the Catskills. You're going to discover what a cozy mystery is. So be sure to join Dawn and me, Donna Fellenberg, for all that and more this Saturday at 10:30 on Catskill Character on Radio Catskill.
Thursdays at 9, it's Connect the Dots with me, David Christian. It's the freeform show where each song leads to the next by way of a musical connection. Think of it as a dive into music's liner notes, exploring the behind-the-scenes connections that show that the distance between genres and decades is often shorter than we think. That's Connect the Dots, Thursday nights at 9, here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. Noah Kalina is an artist and photographer based in Lumberland. He is holding a workshop at the Catskill Art Space in Livingston Manor called Why We Photograph with Noah Kalina, starting on April 6th. This class will discuss why people take photographs, what happens to photos after they're taken, and why taking photos is important even when everyone else is doing it. Noah's an accomplished photographer with clients such as Google, MoMA, Gucci, Levi, New York Times. The Catskill Art Space says this class is for anyone who's interested in art and photography, but it won't teach you how to use a camera. So welcome to the program, Noah.
Thank you, Patricio. Great to be here.
So, you know, this workshop explores why people photograph. So I'm curious about why you photograph, why you get up in the morning before dawn to take photographs, yeah. Follow your brick wall, brick wall to your stone wall. Or take self-portraits every day? What motivates you to do that?
Great question. Sometimes I don't even know why I do it. I think mostly now it's because I think it makes me feel good. It's my practice. It's my art practice. So it actually makes me feel alive and it gives me purpose. But ultimately, I question this all the time, and it's like, why? Why bother? Who cares? Like,
right.
Beyond myself, like, what is this for? So I thought it would be a great idea to bring these sort of questions to the Catskill Art Space.
So, yeah, just talk about that. How did this class come about in collaboration with CAS? Like, whose idea was it?
Yeah, I was talking to Sally, who runs CAS, and just talking about the classes that they do and the things that I was thinking about. And I just sort of suggested it as something that might be interesting to the community and to the photographers in the community, just as a place to go and just sort of talk about pictures, photographs, art, and really dig a little deeper and not have it be maybe just about how to take photos with a camera, but more existential and philosophical. So, you know, when I suggested it to Sally, she thought it was a good idea, and we sort of put it together and are seeing if we can make it happen.
Yeah, and, you know, especially like you mentioned it in even the press release about why is it important to make photography even in the era that we live in with cell phones and there's imaging's everywhere, you know, everywhere, Facebook, Twitter, not Twitter, X now, Instagram, it's everywhere. It seems like everyone has become quote unquote a photographer now.
Yeah.
And how are you dealing with that as a person who makes images for a living?
I mean, that's funny. That's nothing new. It's funny when one of my most famous projects was self-portrait every day, you know, and I think a lot of people might just know me for that. And when that sort of became viral in 2006, I was actually in a show in Austria called We Are All Photographers Now. Mm. So that kind of theme about the sort of ubiquitous nature of photographs and how because digital photography has made it so accessible and so easy for a lot of people to essentially become photographers, what this means and, you know, not only for the art itself, but culture by and large.
Right. I mean, it's amazing that, like I said, this huge boom of now photography that we have in the digital age and how easy it is to get a camera, to get a image made now.
So
do you see your role in photography changing as it goes on? Because now you're expanding, because now you're only not doing photography, now you're doing video, you're doing work like that.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I'm of the age and the generation right at that shift from film to digital. And, you know, it's always an existential crisis for people who work in this medium. Like, there's always something happening that seems like it's the doomsday scenario. And digital, the advent and introduction of digital photography initially sort of was really hard for a lot of the old guard photography to deal with, because seemed like a lot of the craft was going to be lost, or, you know, maybe there's a gatekeeping element to that too, where it's like it's so much easier to get in now and you don't have to do all the things you used to have to do to become what might be called a professional photographer. I mean, personally, I just like embracing the new technologies if they resonate with me. Obviously, there's a lot of things that happen and I'm not all that into right now. But, you know, an artist, I think, does need to evolve over time and, like, you know, stay hip to the trends.
Right.
And video has been appealing to me for many years, and I sort of have been making them in one way or another casually for the past decade or so. But now I just feel like, personally, just as a way to express myself, pivoting into that a little bit more and using YouTube has become fun and interesting, especially when it seems like online and the way we consume things has become this thing where you just sort of have to capture people's attention in different ways. And still photography is harder to do that.
Yeah. Let's talk about that YouTube channel. You had a YouTube channel for a while, but YouTube sort of really changed it and sort of making it sort of a documentary of sorts. I mean, you have, you know, you're searching for the right adapter for your old school camera that you have. And my favorite one is Alternate Timeline Noah.
Oh, yeah.
When you call yourself. And best is that you're out in the field and all of a sudden you have a golden fold in your pocket. So,
yeah, alternate timeline Noah is a character. I'm sort of developing characters and I'm just sort of making it up as I go along. I think a lot of people might describe this type of content, if you will, for lack of a better word, vlogging, video vlogging, essentially. And I mean, I feel like that might have a negative connotation, but I don't know. I mean, I guess we try to look for words that describe as succinctly as possible what it is we're trying to do. So I am regularly making videos now. And while doing that, you know, I'm sort of coming up with new ideas and using these alternative characters to sort of represent different personas that I feel like I might have in my head, and I can express them through different physical embodiments of myself. So alternative timeline Noah is like the Noah who decided to become a stockbroker instead of an artist.
Right. Has kids. Those songs, yeah. So and where do you see the channel going? Because now, you know, with the pandemic, it sort of really boomed that the streaming and the YouTubers, and sort of that's really like now like commonplace now. Yeah. Where do you see your channel going?
I never know how to answer these questions. I have no idea. It's sort of like, we'll see. You know, hopefully it develops an audience. I mean, it is still rather small at this point, but you know, in time, we'll see. Just like the characters on the show are evolving, so will the channel, and we'll see what happens if it becomes something that is more of a commercial endeavor, or if it's something that is just remains fun and creative. Well, not to say that they can't both work simultaneously.
Well, I mean, you have like in your YouTube channel right for now 50,000 subscribers to your channel.
Yeah, roughly. You know, losing every day, but mostly because most of those followers came from my viral videos, where that channel only for over 10 years that channel existed with only 3 videos that were all had millions of views each, and now I'm making these sort of regular, more casual type of videos. So I think a lot of people might have signed up with different expectations,
right,
and are finding me to be possibly annoying, but you know,
it's a daily check-in with Noah. So
yeah,
I mean, I've you know, looked through your YouTube channel, and one of the favorite ones I like are the ones you talk about the sort of behind the scenes of your photo shoots. Like you talked about was it visiting NASA or some kind of airport and you were photographing engines?
Oh yeah, General Electric,
that's what it was. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's funny, for the longest time I always kind of felt, and in some ways I still do, that with photography is magic, in the sense that the photo is the end goal, and that's what we're seeing, and everything that it takes to make that should maybe be shrouded in some kind of mystery, because if we were to actually know how it was made, you might not think that the end result is all that special. And the parallel to magicians is like, you see a trick,
yeah,
and you think it's amazing, but then you learn how to do it and then it's not as special anymore. So I was always hesitant to sort of give away the behind the scenes.
Right.
But I don't know, times change. And maybe I'm loosening up on that a little bit, and I'm more willing to sort of, you know, give away the behind the scenes, the tricks,
right,
as you will.
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting, just the stories of how you got these photographs and how that happened, and you know, standing out in the freezing cold on for a couple of minutes or a couple of seconds, actually, just to get a photograph.
Definitely, certain things I think do, you know, the backstory does help inform the final result. Mm. And I think a lot of these projects are so old now that I feel like it's sort of okay to revisit them and sort of provide new context.
I mean, one of the things I when I watch your YouTube channel is, because I also, one of the favorite parts I like is you're intercutting yourself, editing the actual show.
Yeah, that's future Noah.
That's future Noah, right? Yeah. Future Noah, I say that timeline Noah. And I every time I watch it, I was like, how much work is he putting into this? Just because you're editing and you're I know you said you're doing it spontaneously, you're not really having like thought out storyboards, I'm sure,
Yeah, very loose outlines, right, if any. So, you know, that's the future Noah editor is a character that I put in to save myself from my poorly organized initial thoughts. So, you know, with the perspective of being in the future and being able to edit, right, you can then add more context to things that I probably missed because I didn't write a script.
So you say you have this workshop coming up as in April 6th. This is the first one. It's 6 hours over four classes, basically for the whole month of April, every Saturday.
That's right.
Happening at the Catskill Art Space, or is this happening at the Laundriette?
Yeah, at the Catskill Art Space, second floor, in the back there, next
in the
to
back.
The Solowitz.
Right. And one thing is interesting also is that you're encouraging, or I don't know if you're encouraging, but you're suggesting that folks can bring their projects to sort of critique. Is that the right word to say?
Yeah, I think we should all look at projects that we're working on, get feedback. It's always good to get feedback from other people, and especially in the community. So, yeah, I think that's going to play an important element to this class, is if people can bring in work that they're working on or projects that they're thinking about, and we can sort of discuss it.
So I'm assuming folks that get more information at the Catskills Art Space website. Noah, before we go, is there anything else that we have not touched on? Do you want folks to know about either the workshop coming up or any projects that you're working on?
I love that. The setup to promote something, which I never really have. I think definitely go check out my YouTube page, subscribe to that. That's where I'm most active now. But yeah, just find me on the internet. I'm probably hanging out somewhere.
You're there. So every day. Noah's there every day on YouTube, especially. So we'll talk to Noah Kalina, photographer, YouTuber. Oh, you have to going to becoming a streamer now?
Yeah, I think that's the next.
That's the next step. You have to go on Twitch, you know?
Is this being streamed right now?
No, it should be. Yeah, go on Twitch, start asking for donations, you know?
Yeah, that's it. That's where we've gone.
Get a hot tub. Who knows?
Yeah. If that's what it takes.
That's what it takes. So we'll talk to Noah Kalina. Like I say, his workshop is coming up in April at the Catskill Art Space. When we come back, we'll talk to Kate Sarah Mitchell about spinning women's history. This is Radio Catskill.
I'm Janice Adams. I do a show to nurture our spirits in these trying times. A show about race, every race, and courage. A show where you and I meet public figures we want to know more about and neighbors from whom we hear too little. Vitamins for the soul. Check out this week's show and get a dose for your day. Join me for the Janice Adams Show, Saturday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
I'm Callison Stratton, a singer-songwriter, public historian, and host of Liberation Station here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Liberation Station is a show that highlights the work of female and femme-presenting performers across genre and time. It's my little way of balancing the scales of representation on the radio. Join me for Liberation Station every Saturday evening at 7 p.m., only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Support comes from Country House Realty, a boutique Catskills real estate brokerage with a new office in Livingston Manor. Country House Realty, exceptional spaces in beautiful places. More at countryhouserealty.com. From Livingston Manor, dining, shopping, and the arts at the gateway to the Catskill Park. LivingstonManorNY.com. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Support comes from...
Hey, this is DJ Chucks of Old School Sessions. Please join me and Selector Starkey at our new time, 8 p.m. to 12 a.m. Saturday night.
Old school, baby. Old school, baby. Old school, baby. Old school, baby.
That's Old School Sessions right here on WJFF, 8 to midnight, Saturday night. Only on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello. Streaming online at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. This Saturday at the Ellenville Public Library and Museum, Kate Sarah Mitchell is giving a presentation on women spinning. It's a celebration of Women's History Month, and Mitchell will discuss the history of textiles, threads, dyes, her experience working with the textile cooperatives in the Peruvian Andes, and her own experience as a textile artist. Welcome to the program, Kate. Good morning.
Thanks. Good morning.
So thank you so much for being on the program. So let's talk about why is it important to highlight women in textiles and in spinning?
I think that spinning textiles is one of the most radical things a person can do because you're creating something from scratch. And through time, we've been separated from our ability to make our own things and build our own lives. And it's empowering to get back to that and to say, oh, I know where my clothes come from. It's like saying, I know where my food comes from.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was just talking to some of the students in BOCES here recently, and it was talking to the electrical group, and we talked about the satisfaction of being able to have something in your house break down and be able to fix it. And you talked about the lost art of either fixing, repairing, or either making something of your own
right.
in your life.
Yeah. No, it's really important, I think, to get that sense of empowerment. And it's also, and I think this is probably true working with electricity as well, it's kind of meditative. You have to be in a zone to do that kind of production creativity at the same time.
Absolutely. So are the contributions of the women to History Month of Textiles often overlooked?
I think, well, all women's contributions have been overlooked in history. There was this great book published in 1996, an archaeologist who wrote a book called Women's Work, The First 20,000 Years. And she really gets into exploring through the archaeological record the contributions that were made through creating textiles and being inventive in developing this space. And a lot of economics has ignored this sphere. And it's an important part of the way society works together. I mean, to ignore your clothes, that sort of has led to us now wearing clothes that are made out of petroleum byproducts, and people sort of just take that for granted.
Yeah, definitely. So tell us about the experience, your experience as a textile artist and your experience in the women's textile cooperatives in the Andes, because, you know, that's a whole different culture of clothing there compared to what we have here in America. Can you talk about your experience?
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. I had been a hobby weaver and spinner and dyer for 15, 20 years. And I got sick, I got cancer, and I thought, I really want to make this a more important part of my life if, you know, I realize that life is short. And so I got really, really involved in trying to spin and weave and do textiles full time. And so I went to FIT, I got a degree. I wanted to go to China and work with silk, but China didn't want me, so I ended up going to Peru, which was excellent. So I worked in about 20 kilometers from Machu Picchu. There's an organization that coordinates six women's textile cooperatives. And these women have been spinning and weaving, and they spin. They don't have spinning wheels. They don't use looms. So they basically are using sticks to spin wool and sticks to do the weaving, and they create the most gorgeous textiles and the most complicated patterns you could imagine, and they learn them from a young age. So my work there was also, again, about empowerment. They were selling their wares in the fair trade market, and so my goal was to get them more money. Mostly their husbands were porters on the Inca Trail for people visiting Machu Picchu, so they were away from home for months at a time. And if the women could earn some money, the men could spend less time on the trail.
Hmm. I mean, that sort of leads into my next question. I was going to ask you, what are some of your favorite memories of that experience? And you mentioned, you're already there, you mentioned some of the experiences you have. I'll keep asking you that. Do you have any favorite memory of you? First of all, I just want to say I'm sorry for that you got sick. I'm assuming everything is better now, or
yeah, life goes on.
Life goes on. That's a great attitude to have, especially facing that. So I'm really sorry for that. So, but let's talk about this trip here. What is sort of your favorite memory of that experience?
just being, I mean, we all live in this beautiful area with mountains and rivers and streams and flowing water. And I can't imagine anything more beautiful than the Hudson and Delaware Valleys, but the Andes are. Mm. And if you can think, I mean, how much you love hiking and being outside at night and seeing the stars, and it's just gorgeous down there. So probably some of my favorite memories are taking trails on mountain cliffs and having the trail just stop in the middle of nowhere and having to climb back out. It's kind of fascinating.
So it's a really different world.
It's a different world. People live in a different way. People walk. People live on these terraced hillsides in the mountains. They have stone houses that they heat with alpaca dung, and then they have, further up the mountain, they'll have the farm where they keep their alpaca, and where they'll have another stone house. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating.
I want to go back into this presentation that you're giving at the Ellenville Public Library and Museum. How has that experience sort of influenced your work going forward? I know you said this motivated you to explore these different options in your life. How has this sort of influenced more of your textile work?
I really wanted to do interiors in the textile world. When I went down there, that was kind of my desire. So after my year there, we presented a nice collection of really crisp, good-looking textiles for interiors, by which I mean like living rooms, like having great pillows for your living rooms and sort of this architectural digest look. And I'm not really pursuing that path anymore. I'm more interested in creative expression from individuals.
Mm. So when folks who will be attending this presentation, will they be able to spin yarn themselves and have that experience?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm bringing silk cocoons. I'll bring linen and flax, plenty of wool, drop spindles, a spinning wheel. We have about an hour there, and, I'm timing it so that I really want people to be engaged in asking questions, but also in getting their hands into the fibers.
Do you see, since the pandemic, or if the pandemic had an effect on this, on the increase of interest of folks getting into textile, getting into weaving, any type of crocheting, type of a fabric, type of art, do you see an increase since the pandemic?
There was a huge increase for the beginning of this millennium. I had a yarn store in Poughkeepsie back in 2005, which I sold. And that was really, from my point of view, kind of the beginning of this growth of people really getting into crafts and handmade things. And, I got involved in Peters Valley. I don't know if you're familiar with Peters Valley. I'm going to be teaching there this spring, a natural dyeing class. But there's a whole range of artisanal crafts there, of printmaking, blacksmithing, ceramics, woodwork. And I think that, I don't think that the pandemic made those things more popular, but I think that they helped people survive.
Yeah, sort of rediscover what they had time. Some folks had time to sort of rediscover things they enjoy to not only stay off boredom or loneliness, but basically loneliness, because it was for some folks during the pandemic it was very lonely, and to have something occupy your mind. And I can see a lot of people got into chess, a lot of people got into, like I said, these types of arts to sort of help stay sane, I guess. Is that correct? Do you think?
I think that's correct. I think it's interesting because I was running some craft studios in Poughkeepsie when the pandemic hit, and the question was, how do we teach teenagers how to sew on Zoom? And I think that we've come a long way in the past 4 years of how to use these tools to do that. But I think people also realize how happy they are to be back together in person.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I think it's now that folks are really appreciating it when the events are happening live, and that feeling when folks are around you and you sort of having a collective experience in the same room.
Mm-hmm.
So folks who are interested in attending this presentation in Ellenville, where can folks get more information?
They can go to the Ellenville Public Library website.
Right.
And I think it's free. And people will have a great time to be playing around with yarns, and everybody can bring some handmade string home with them. But they do want you to register in advance.
Right, so you could definitely check out the website. It's this, the presentation is happening on March 16th at 1 p.m. at the Ellenville Public Library and Museum, the Joseph Y. Resnick Memorial Building. Kate, also, do you want to give out your website if folks are interested in seeing your work and what you're doing in textile?
Oh, sure, I'd love to. KateSarahMitchell.com.
KateSarahMitchell.com. Well, Kate.
Right, and Sarah has an H.
Sarah.